He lost his job because of layoffs. And that was not a serious problem. He always figured he could get another one. After all, he was qualified, experienced, and had a good record. He applied to all the companies within driving distance. No job. He put in his application in all the employment agencies. Still, no job. He and his wife prayed. Again, no job. He got others to pray. Still, no job. Then he got serious. The unemployment checks ran out. The savings account ran low. The cupboard was getting bare. He was on his feet every day looking for a job. He was on his knees every night looking for justice. Then this one had happened. At first it was a feeling. Then it was a haunting thought. And after that, it was a growing concern. God has forgotten me. God, he thought, has forsaken me. A concerned father and mother paced back and forth in the waiting room. It was all right, they thought. A competent doctor is caring for their child. Minutes stretched into hours. Why is it taking so long? Then is when it happened. It started with one and then sort of spread to the other like a cold spreads to one another. Our child is not going to be all right. Something's wrong. They prayed. Yet they sensed that God was not listening. They felt as if God had left them alone. You ever felt that way? Did you ever feel like God forgot you or that God had forsaken you? Spiritually, have you ever just felt isolated, even deserted by God? Even without unusual circumstances, a Christian can experience that. At times, God seems close and intimate, like a close friend. And then there, for no apparent reason, God can seem distant. Your prayers are like rubber balls bouncing off the ceiling. Now, sometimes that's because we have forsaken him. But there are times when we feel like he has forsaken us. I've had that experience. One of the first times was when I first got out of seminary and was in the ministry. It was not a particularly trying time. There were no particular pressing problems. I just felt like God had deserted me. The experience lasted for weeks. I became concerned, so I read my Bible by the hour, and I prayed, and yet I still felt the same way. I remember staying up one night, meditating and praying and agonizing, nothing. And I fell asleep. The next morning, I woke up, and I remembered something I heard Billy Graham say. Back in those days when he had those huge crusades, he would have a seminar at the same time for pastors and for men in the ministry. I attended several of those. On this particular occasion, there were 1,000 ministers packed into an auditorium. And Billy Graham was speaking to us. And one of the things he said was that he read the Psalms and Proverbs every day. And then he made this statement. Every experience that a believer can have, the psalmist had. It made an impression upon me. I've never forgotten it. And on that morning when I woke up, that's what popped into my head. So I thought to myself, if what I'm experiencing spiritually is in the Psalms, then I'm going to read the Psalms. I decided I was going to spend the whole day, if necessary, reading the Psalms. If I had to, I would read the whole book. I ate breakfast and I began to read. And sure enough, I found the Psalm that I felt was an echo of my experience. I learned something that day I've never forgotten. One of the most profound spiritual experiences of my life. And what I'd like to do today is share it with you. I invite you to join with me as we look at Psalm 13, a very short and a very powerful psalm. Psalm 13. David says, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me? Forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long will my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and hear, O Lord my God. Lighten my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemy say, I have prevailed against him. Lest those who trouble me rejoice when I am moved. But I have trusted in your mercy. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me." We do not know the specific problem that David was facing when he wrote this psalm. Spurgeon said, "All attempts to find its birthplace are but guesses." We don't know the specifics, but obviously from reading the psalm, David was going through some kind of an excruciating experience. And in the midst of it, he felt like God had deserted him. The psalm naturally falls into three parts. In the first part, David just laments. That's a fancy word for complains. The second thing he does is he prays. And then he expresses some confidence in the Lord. I want us to walk through this psalm and listen carefully to what David is saying, because there is profound truth in these verses. Let's begin with his complaint. He says in verse 1, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me?" Now, when he says in verse 1, "How long will you forget me?" the idea is, I've asked you for something, and you've either delayed or you've refused to give it to me. Now, how long is this going to last? And he says again, "How long will you hide your face from me?" Now, in the scripture, to hide your face would mean that you're withholding a favor. To smile on your face is to show a favor. So David is saying, I feel like God has forgotten me, and worse yet, forsaken me. And then he says, how long is this going to go on? Is this going to go on forever? That is his point. Years ago, I knew a fella who moved from Dallas to L.A. because of a job. He moved in October, but he had to leave his family in Dallas because of the housing situation. He had a tough time. He looked and he looked and he looked. We prayed with him, and we prayed and we prayed. And finally, he found a house and put a deposit on it. All that was needed was for his house in Dallas to sell. He waited and waited and waited. And we prayed and we prayed and we prayed. All this began in October. Christmas came. He had to go back to Dallas. It was the only chance he had seen his family in 3 months. By January, it had been even longer. Imagine 3 months, except for a few days at Christmas time, without your family, not seeing your wife and your kids. At that point, he said to me, "What do you do when there is nothing?" That's the way David felt. that as far as his spiritual life was concerned, there was nothing. God had forgotten him. God had forsaken him. David's heart felt that it was as out of tune as his harp. Now, like my friend from Dallas said, what do you do when there is nothing? Well, you do something, and David did something. Look at verse 2. How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? In other words, he took counsel in his soul. Now, the idea here is that he started planning. When God doesn't do something, you need God to intervene, and he does nothing. What do? Well, you come up with a counsel. You come up with a plan. Matter of fact, you may have counsel after counsel and plan after plan and proposal after proposal, attempting to do anything. Each one was worthless because apparently none of that worked. The multiplication of devices only multiplied his sorrow. If this were written when he was being hunted and hounded by Saul, you can imagine the turmoil. First, he tried seeking refuge among the Moabites. Then he was in the wilderness. From there, he was an outlaw hiding in the cave of Adullam. And then he was hunted like a wild animal. You can imagine that all that time he was crying out to God, and he felt like God was doing nothing. Luther said, his heart was like a raging sea in which all sorts of counsels moved up and down. He tries on all hands to find a hole on which to make his escape. He thinks of various plans and still is utterly at loss as to what to advise. David is saying, Lord, you have forsaken me, and my own counsel has failed me. And as if all that's not bad enough, look at verse 2 again. At the end of it, he says, how long will my enemy be exalted over me? So God's forgotten him. His own counsel has not worked. That's failed. And his enemy has prevailed. So he just feels alone, forsaken, forgotten. Ever been there? Ever felt that way? Notice he says four times, how long, how long, how long. In two verses, four times, he wants to know how long. In this situation, he does not ask why, though that comes up in other passages. In this passage, he just asks how long. How long is this going to happen? There's a French proverb that says, sickness comes on horseback and goes away on foot. That's the way David felt about his troubles. They came on horseback and they went away crawling. Someone has said, the intensity of the affliction renders it trying to our fortitude, but it is by the continuance of it that patience is put to the test. It is not under the sharpest, but the longest trial that we are most in danger of fainting. In the first case, the soul collects all of its strength and feels in earnest to call in help from above. But in the last, the mind lapses and sinks into despondency. When Job was accosted with evil things in quite succession, he bore it with becoming fortitude. But when he could see no end to his trouble, then he sank under them. Now, that's what's going on with David. He is feeling deserted and forsaken and alone. Notice what he does. As desperate as that situation is, what he does is he complains. These first two verses are a complaint. Now, what do we do when we have this kind of a situation, or for that matter, the smallest kind of a problem? We complain. You say, oh, great, now I've got biblical justification for doing that. The pastor said you could complain. Granted, but one other little observation. Notice who he complained to. You see, he's complaining to the Lord. Now, my suggestion is that if you're going to complain and there is a place for that, then do it to the Lord. At least begin there. Now, I'm not suggesting it's not legitimate to complain to somebody else. I am most assuredly saying that you should begin by complaining to the Lord, and maybe that is sufficient. I know this. Some people complain too much. They go like butterflies from one flower to another, finding somebody they can light on that will listen so they can complain some more. Maybe we grow spiritually when we learn to complain to the Lord. But there's a second thing David does in this passage. He laments. He complains, but he prays. Look at verse 3. Consider and hear, O Lord my God. Lighten my eyes. Now, what he's doing is he's praying for God to answer him. Consider is the idea of look, and that probably corresponds to the fact that he said earlier, you hid your face from me. Hey, consider, look here, is sort of the idea. And hear me probably corresponds to the idea that you forgot me. Hey, hello, remember me? He's trying to get God's attention. Lighten my eyes. And this, of course, is an expression, not that I'm about to go to sleep, not that I need insight, but I need renewed strength. So he's praying to God to hear him, to deliver him, and in the meantime, to strengthen him. Would you please mark that down? When you are going through any kind of a situation, especially one like we're talking about today, the one thing you need to do is pray for strength. And God grants it. God graciously grants it. So you need to remember to constantly pray, to constantly ask God to give you strength. Someone has said David was resolved not to be dumb when God seemed to be deaf. Even when you don't think God is listening, pray for strength. Now, what he does in this passage is he gives two reasons why God should answer this prayer. Look at verse 3. Lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lord, you need to answer me for the simple reason that if you don't, I am going to die. Now, he may have meant that literally. He may have literally meant that there were people chasing him around Palestine and wanted very much to sever his head from the rest of his body. Now, we're not usually in that situation, but there are times when we feel like that, do we not? Maybe it's the kind of situation I described at the beginning, where you're without a job and you can't get one and the savings account is being depleted and the credit card debt is going up and the cupboard is getting bare and you say, Lord, do something lest I die. So he's That's his plea. And that's the reason he gives the Lord for answering him. He gives a second reason the Lord should answer this prayer. Lest my enemies say, I have prevailed against him. Lest those who trouble me rejoice when I am moved. Now, David has enemies, and as I said at the beginning, we're not sure exactly what situation he's talking about. Maybe it was when he was fleeing from Saul. But his point here is that his enemies are God's enemies. And so he's saying, Lord, you don't want them to prevail. So I'm asking you to deliver me, to intervene, lest I die and they delight in my death. So that's his argument. But he's praying. He's asking God to intervene. He's asking God to answer his prayer. Let me ask you a question. What do you do when God isn't doing something? Well, here are some options. One is you can get bitter, get angry. And I suspect that a lot of us do that. Some people express that anger by blowing up, but other people just stuff it. But anger is probably the first thing we do. That's the natural result of frustration. You get angry. That's what happened to Jonah. He expected God to judge Nineveh. And when God didn't, Jonah chapter 4 opens with the word, and he was exceedingly angry. It's because God didn't do what he wanted God to do. So when that happens, we get angry. The other thing is we give up. We throw in the towel. We say, I quit. Well, David didn't do any of that. What David did, even when God seemed like he was forsaking him, is he prayed. And he kept praying. And he argued with God as to why he should answer. Lest I die, and lest my enemies prevail against me. Lord, you are my God. Notice, that's what he says. You are my God. So I'm asking you to intervene, lest my enemies make a comedy out of my tragedies. So speak to me, please. O Lord, my God. Verse 3. Then David does a third thing. Number one, he complains. Number two, he prays. Number three, he decides he's going to trust God no matter what happens. Look at verse 5. He says, but in light of all of this, but I have trusted in your mercy. Now, what he's saying is, I have trusted, but the implication is that he is still trusting. Even though David felt like God had forgotten him and forsaken him, he said, I am going to trust you. I've done it in the past, and I'm going to trust you. Notice what he says in verse 5. I trust in your mercy. He's not claiming any kind of merit. He's not saying, I'm going to trust you because I've been a good boy. He's saying, I'm going to trust you because you're a good God. You are gracious and you are merciful. So, I am asking you to intervene, and I'm going to trust you no matter what. Sometimes our trials and troubles go on and on. And even though they are sometimes short-lived in the overall scheme of things, they seem like a long time. How long? How long? How long? How long? Four times. Now he says, but I have trusted. But I'm still going to trust. But I'm trusting you. The moment may seem like a month, but I'm trusting you. A week in prison, someone has said, is longer than a month at liberty. But Lord, you're merciful. You're gracious. You may temporarily seem to have departed, but I believe that you are merciful. So I don't care how long this goes on, I'm going to trust you. Did you write that down? You may temporarily have appeared to depart, but I am trusting that you are merciful. One preacher said, he has to engage to be our God forever. I'm sorry. He who has engaged to be our God forever cannot depart forever. So even though this has gone longer than I can bear, I still believe you're merciful, and I'm going to trust you no matter what. Job said, though he slay me, I will serve him. So as a shipwrecked mariner clings to the mast, David clung to his faith. Or more accurately, he clung to his Father. Someone has written, no external change has taken place, but his complaint and his prayer has helped him to tighten his grip on God and has transported him into a certain future of praise. Lord, I am going to trust you. Now, let me tell you what he's going to do in the meantime. Look at verse 5. I have trusted, my heart shall rejoice in your salvation. Now, this is an expression of his confidence in the Lord. I'm going to rejoice in your salvation. He's not talking about his spiritual salvation, of going to heaven. He's talking about deliverance. He is confident that God is going to deliver him in this situation. And so he's saying, I have trusted you. I am trusting you. I'm going to trust you. I don't care how long this is. I'm going to trust you no matter what happens. And I'm going to rejoice someday. I'm going to rejoice in your salvation. So what David is doing is expressing his continual, constant confidence in the Lord. I am going to trust you no matter what, no matter how long. Very important. The writer to the Hebrews says, cast not away your confidence. That's what David did not do. He didn't cast away his confidence. At the darkest hour, you will have to make a choice. You will either trust God or you will either doubt God. If you lose your confidence, you will lose your joy. But this is a choice. Notice, I have trusted, my heart shall rejoice. This is a choice. I'm choosing to do this. I'm determined I'm going to do this, no matter what happens and no matter how long this goes on. So don't cast away your confidence. Imagine standing beside a lake and throwing in your most valuable possessions, your diamond ring, all your money. It has been suggested that that's what some do. When the pressure gets heavy and the hour gets dark, they cast away their confidence, like throwing your valuables into a lake. That is what David didn't do. David did not cast away his confidence. One more thing. Look at verse 6. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. He has dealt bountifully with me in the past. Based on that, I can rejoice and sing his praise in the present. So though there may be lightning and thundering and a storm brewing, I am going to sing. How's that for an attitude? The modern version is singing in the rain. Doesn't matter what's happening. I'm going to sing because I am trusting the Lord. I'm going to rejoice the day he delivers me. In the meantime, I am just going to sing. If you trust God in the dark, he will change your midnight into music. Do you hear that? If you trust God in the dark, he'll change your midnight into music. Someone has written, when our soul is much discouraged by the roughness of the way, and the cross we have to carry seems heavy each day, when some cloud that overshadows hides our Father's face from view, oh, 'tis well then to remember he has blessed us hitherto. Looking back the long years over, what a varied path, and yet all the way his hand has led us past each hindrance that we've met, given us pleasant places, cheering us all the journey through, passing through the deepest waters, he has blessed us hitherto. Surely then our soul shall trust him, though the clouds be dark overhead. We've a friend that draws closer when our other friends have fled. When our pilgrimage is over and the gates are sweeping through, we shall see with clearer vision how he blessed us hitherto. Notice, I am going to sing because he has dealt bountifully with me. Has the Lord dealt bountifully with you in the past? Then no matter what comes next, and no matter how long it lasts, you can sing because of what he's done with you and for you in the past. Amen. So to sum it all up, when God apparently forgets you and forsakes you, then here's what you need to do. Complain, pray, and trust him no matter what. That's what I learned that day many decades ago. That's what I got from this passage. That my relationship with the Lord doesn't depend on how I feel. It certainly doesn't depend on whether or not I'm getting an answer to prayer. It doesn't depend on my circumstances. Oh, I beg you, hear me. I beg you, hear me. It depends on whether or not I'm trusting the Lord. And I made a decision that day that I would trust God no matter what. And no matter how long it lasts. Now, you got to be made out of that kind of stuff if you're going to make it through this kind of a problem. There are three kinds of people that need to hear this message. New believers need to hear what I'm saying today. I can't prove what I'm about to say, but I've seen it happen over and over again. There's some new Christians who have a dramatic and emotional conversion. God seems to just work miracles for them. They sense his presence. They feel his presence. They see him work in their lives. They're on cloud nine. And then all of a sudden, there is nothing. I think God does that deliberately. Can't prove it. Don't know of a passage I can quote. It just seems to me that God sometimes gives us a great start And then he says, now I'm going to send some trials and see if you're going to really trust me. So you, if you're new at this, that's what you need to know. That this is the trying of your faith. 1 Peter chapter 1. Second group of people that need to hear this are faithful believers. If you've walked with the Lord for a long time, you are well aware that in the Christian life there are mountains and there are valleys. There are showers of blessings and seasons of drought and barrenness. The problem is, if you're not careful, you hit the barrenness and think something is wrong with you. And there may be. That's a possibility. And you should check it out. But there may not be. Maybe that God is just simply trusting you. A pastor of a bygone day said it like this: I know that as night and shadows are good for flowers, and moonlight and dew are better than continual sun, so is Christ's presence of special use, and that has nourishing virtue in it, and gives up sap to humility, and puts on edge on hunger, and furnishes a fair sea field of faith to put forth, and to exercise its finger in gripping, it seems, what is good. But then there comes those times of drought. So the issue is, will you trust God? When God doesn't seem to be saying anything, it's what he's already said that you need to hear. There's a third group of people that need to hear this. Not only new Christians and not only faithful believers, but suffering saints. Those who are going through a particular hard time, you need to know that God tests our faith. Hear me. Hear me well. God is actively working in your life. And one of the ways he does that is he will bring situations into your life that'll stretch your faith. He's going to see if you will trust him. So if you're going through a tough time, if there's something you struggle with, then what you've got to do is trust the Lord to lighten your eyes, to use the expression in this passage, to give you strength to get through it and to learn from it. So that is your most important need, that you trust God no matter what. Amen. That you don't live by your feelings. You don't live by your circumstances. You live by faith. When I was in college, I knew a fellow named Larry. His name was Larry Parker. Back in those days, there was a ministry called Campus Crusade for Christ. He worked for that organization. One night, in a fraternity house, several students threw questions and objections and doubts at him. I heard him say later that when he left, he was drained physically, emotionally, and spiritually. He said, and I quote, "I was numb. I didn't feel anything. I'd lost, and they had won. I didn't feel God's presence at all." Then he said, "I looked up to heaven. And I said, God, I don't feel your presence right now, but I am going to trust you no matter what." Let's pray. Lord, thank you for giving us the opportunity to trust you. Now grant us the grace that we do it consistently, that we not look at circumstances, but we look at what you've already said in your word, that you give us the grace to sing and rejoice, even when things aren't going our way, even when things are against us. Lord, teach us this most indispensable lesson of the spiritual life. Teach us, oh Lord, to trust you no matter what.